Hello and welcome to Millennial 2017, number 13. Yes, and this is with the Great Order, Jared from the Great Order. And yes. You have a YouTube. Welcome. And you have a YouTube channel. When did you begin it? When did you start the channel?
In September, pretty much at the same time I launched a website of the same name, thegreatorder.com. Yeah, so it's all pretty new. Right.
Yeah, it is pretty new. And how would you describe your channel? I mean, would you describe it as identitarian, alt-right? How would you describe it?
Well, if you don't mind, of course I knew, first of all, hello and thank you for having me on. It's great to be here. But if you don't mind, I wanted to kind of give it a little opening because I knew, of course, we were going to start with something like this. Being that I'm new and, hey, how'd I get here and what's it all about, right? I was sitting and thinking of what, you know, the most honest way to answer that would be and maybe most useful. And there's a lot of ways I can answer it. But it occurred to me that a few years ago, I was asking myself somewhat regularly, something I think everyone, especially every man, should ask himself. And it's what's worth living for. And you really can't ask that without its twin, its mirror, what's worth dying for. And I want to make clear, I wasn't asking that out of despair. You know, I love my life, but I've always been driven by a drive for sincere living. That doesn't mean being super serious all the time. I like to mix depth and lightness. But nonetheless, sincere living and asking that penetrating question, it, you know, makes you just stare at yourself. And as an aside, first of all, most people say, their kids, which I think is interesting because their kids is basically saying their genes, which is, I think we're going to get to that later, and you know, drives a lot of what we all do and are interested in. But my initial answers for myself were that I wanted to do my bit in general to move towards a society that where honor and honesty is a boon instead of a liability, as it seems to be now, passing into the world the love that I've been given from my family. Aligning with what I am or, you know, my particular talents and communication or creativity. So there were these layers of identity that I, you know, was able to find in myself, articulate in myself. I really like that metaphor of the Russian doll, like nested layers of identity. I think that's something that plays into a lot of how I see things. You have to understand yourself on all these levels. So I had a sense of myself as my individual temperament and talents, my connection to my family, being a good citizen, being a good an honorable person in general. But there was a link there that wasn't as defined. And it was always there, but it wasn't as defined. And when I asked this question about what's worth living for and what's worth dying for in the months that followed, I think when you ask something like that, you just kind of have to let it go and let your intuition take you. I felt this like vastness pulling me, something mysterious pulling me. And this is where it took me. It took me into a deeper interface with that heritage, that ancestry of being of European descent. And I connected a lot of dots, and some of it was in, you know, an academic way, reading things, and I was led to things, and some of it was just personal. Like I'd gone on a trip, my second time I'd gone to Europe, I went to Germany and Holland. I'm from the States. Spent most of that trip in Germany, and it was a wonderful trip. But what happened was when I came back in the couple of years since I had come back, it's like a seed had been planted and something grew in me. And I was very just drawn to Europe. I'd put up wallpapers of the Black Forest. I'd been in the Black Forest in Germany, and I could go into detail with other things. I discovered stuff from my youth that just made sense and connected a lot of dots with being drawn to this, but it came alive. It came alive in me. And this was all before. This was a foundation, if you could imagine, prior to. So this is all building in me. And then 2 years ago, fall 2015, the refugee thing starts happening. And not to say that I was a different person before that, but it definitely clicked. You know, I think that it would have stimulated that desire to protect and defend Europe anyway. But with everything that had been in the background of what I just described, it made it that much more poignant and powerful. Then I learned about Rotterdam as well. And it's changed my life. Again, I could go into detail if anyone wants and look at times even when I was a young kid, that spirit of Europeanness and ancestry was definitely alive and in me. But this, all of what I just described, just brought it into the fore so much more powerfully. And I want to get this across to people, like, there's a lot of things to possibly despair of, and I definitely don't want to make light of the actual people who have suffered and even died because of the ridiculous things going on. But there is a part of me, and I want to share this with people, that is inspired. Like, what a frigging time to be alive. What a moment in history. You know, we were born in this moment, and it's up to us to do something about it. And I find a certain amount of inspiration from that, you know, because I think the people who are going to be listening to this and drawn to Melanie Yule, you know, there's a lot of different ideas out there, as there well should be. We'll talk about that. But I think it's safe to say most of us probably believe in meaning. We're at least not nihilist and relativist. We believe in meaning. We believe in greatness. So that is what started all of this. I mean, I could talk now about specifically the movement and whatnot, what I
feel. That's very interesting. I think that the migrant crisis definitely woke a lot of people up. It sort of alerted people to the urgency of the situation. Made them realize there is actually something. There is actually a threat to this thing that you value, and for some people, they didn't even know that they valued it until they realized that it was a threat. And for other people like yourself, they were sort of getting into their European identity, becoming consciously aware of it for the first time, and then this hit. You know, I mean, the alt-right had existed. I'd say that's true. The alt-right had existed for about 2 years by that point, and then the migrant crisis hit, and suddenly had a big increase in subscribers. Various other people said similar things at the same time, because it was a sort of awakening.
Absolutely. Yeah, as I said, part of it was intuitive and personal, and part of it was I myself had for almost 2 years, as you said, prior to that, been just casually reading things. Countercurrents was an early discovery of mine about this time 4 years ago, and that was big for me. And when the migrant crisis happened, it was as if dots connected, like, oh, these things people are talking about on the internet, and I was flirting with and not sure how serious this was, like, no, it's happening. It's all here right in front of your face.
And you can't believe that anyone misses it. You know, this is the funny thing. Here we are 2 years later, and a large number of people still don't understand the situation.
Right, especially here in the States. And I try to tell people, and they ask me, you know, why am I concerned about what's going on in Europe? And I'm dumbfounded by that, because, you know, in terms of identity, that's a complex thing too. Of course, I appreciate being American, but I think I've always sensed, even again before I was more conscious of it, America as an outpost, not an outpost, an outgrowth of European civilization. But in terms of
I think that for a lot of Americans, there's a large part of American pride seems to be in distinguishing themselves from Europe. So I can understand, because they don't want to feel like they're dependent, you know, culturally, in some sense, on Europe, on the old world. So
right,
they sort of run from it.
Yeah, or it's just a novelty. Like, you know, I went on a cruise to Europe once, and now I have my Europe story. You know, it's it's a lot deeper than that. And I like to think, I know this is kind of simple, but we have so much to learn from each other. If we could somehow combine some of that original American, you know, can-do spirit, the entrepreneurial spirit, the inventiveness, with the roots, the unbelievable roots in European history, and of course the land itself, which again, I had a very just personal, organically welling up experience hiking in the Black Forest, being in certain areas in Europe. I have been to Britain as well, England, and out in the rolling hills of the countryside, and that was amazing too. I'd love to one day start a program for people of European ancestry in the States to go to Europe, like they do, of course, with Israel. You know, there's subsidized trips that young Jewish people in the States take to Israel to show them Israel. It's called Birthright. I would love to do something like that for Europe, you know, to get kids connected to their roots. But to get back to where you started about the movement. So here's what I say. Like, the better aspects, the better angels of all this, and this is just my take, is there are people, this is what I connect with when I see people online or writing things, is there are people looking for a way out of this disjointed, frenetic, modern consciousness. And I make a distinction of saying consciousness because sometimes people will say, oh, well, I hate the modern world, and then a critic will be like, well, what are you going to go back with no technology? You wouldn't last 10 minutes if I transported you back 1,000 years ago. And I'm like, yeah, I get it. You know, I'm a creature of my day and age as well. You know, I like that we have anesthesia and all that. So it's more the consciousness. It's not technology in and of itself. Technology in and of itself is somewhat neutral. It's the consciousness. But I sense that there are people out there trying to right the ship and addressing the flattening globalism that's out there. And as we were talking about a moment ago before we went live, I see this as beyond a political movement. It's a culture. It's self and communal development. It's a way of orienting yourself towards the world. And of course, there's going to be variation of that. It's going to be a little messy. It's going to happen organically. But I'm about, like, my whole thing is trying to clarify this, the disjointedness and the unnecessary dichotomies that people are given. Like, sometimes the left, it's not like what they say is entirely untrue in every circumstance. It's that they don't give the whole side of the story. So, for example, in a civic sense, I know we could debate philosophically, are there such thing as rights? But let's just say in a civic sense, people are part of a society, so they have certain rights. And you hear the left go on and on and on and on about rights, 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 rights. We don't hear people talk about the other leg of that, responsibilities. You know, I'm always looking into, like, if you walk on two legs. So a lot of these issues are, they kind of have to be harmonized by looking at these two different poles. Same thing with freedom and discipline. So
one thing I would say just before you go into this, I think it's, this is a way for modern cultures to be defined. It's the rights that people have. And sometimes also the responsibility, like the responsibility to be tolerant, the responsibility to, and pay your taxes or whatever, but mostly it's the rights. And even if you have rights and responsibilities in equal measure, that's still, to my mind, a shallow way of defining and identity. I think, and I don't even really know where this comes from, except I don't even think it's American, because the first thought is, well, it's probably a New World thing, because that's them building their culture by defining, by putting some things in black and white so that people can then work with that. But I don't think even that's true, because I think 100 years ago, American identity was more solid than it is now. And it wasn't just rights and responsibilities. There were actual traditions and identities, ancestral identities, that I think now have been obliterated. So that now, you know, probably by mass consumerism, I suppose, so that now all we're left with is rights and responsibilities.
Exactly. I totally agree with that. Yeah, I think that we've been cut off from our roots, and it's a tragedy, and it's killing people. Of course, I was just, you know, using it as an example to show the whole, you know, you got to walk on two legs kind of thing. But my whole thing is, I want to help Europeans fall in love with their people of European descent, fall in love with their culture, their ethnicity, their background again, and not only survive, because I know, you know, there's all the numbers and demographics and stats we can get into, but also thrive. And I don't think we can thrive unless we have those deep roots. So I totally agree with that. I'm also about the sanctity of the day-to-day, the numinous and the day-to-day ritual. And I have always been somewhat interested, even before consciously being aware of all this, these movements, the reason you and I are talking, is I have always been somewhat interested in morality and aesthetics. I think I've talked about this on some of my videos, my kind of red pills, you could say, or my journey, I don't have that story that a lot of others do where it was a political journey through different parts of the political spectrum. It was more realizing things, like you said, in our consumerist culture that didn't sit well with me. And I think a lot of people feel that kind of walking in two worlds thing, like you're not connecting to what's around you. You know, as a person with myself and my family, I feel very well adjusted, but and thank God for that, because compared to like what I see out in the world and what the majority of people seem to value in modern popular mainstream culture, I've always felt at odds with it. So the whole
I think a lot of people do, actually. I think a lot of people do feel at odds with it, with the modern world. I think it's if you're a thinking person at all, there isn't a sense of something for you to do. You know, there isn't a sense that your society values that capacity in you.
Yeah. I feel like I keep delaying the whole, your question. So in terms of alt-right, just to, I don't want to sound like I'm skirting it. So my thing is, I was trying to define where I'm coming from. So if people feel that everything I just explained is alt-right, then fine. I'm so new. I want to meet some of the people involved in this more. I want to be out in the public a little bit more, speak. And like I said, maybe even in real life, meet some of the people that are involved in this. Because I have a few different ideas of like the main banners or the main camps within that alt-right umbrella. So, you know, I'm not necessarily calling myself alt-right in my material, but that's just kind of where I am right now.
No, it's a label that has always been quite nebulous.
Yeah, I understand
and
that.
I think is now undergoing another sort of bout of transformation, and I don't know what it will be at the end of it.
Yeah, I mean, I can tell you this. I look at some of the critiques of it as well, and I think I actually am coming into this, maybe because I'm new, but I'm coming into this with a lot of optimism. I've heard critiques that say that it all is about this shallow focus just on the race or peoplehood thing. And even though, yeah, we have a crisis on our hands, and you just heard what I said about my deep feeling for my European roots, I don't think that that's the whole, I mean, it's the main thing, but I don't think that it's fair to reduce it to that, let's say. Because I see a lot of voices that I listen to that are speaking in what I would say is a big picture way about what the heart of the beast is to me, which I'll get onto in a minute, but to me it's kind of like fragmentary, disjointed way of thinking and disjointed way of living. I think that's what is at the heart of all of the heads of the Hydra that springs out into this modern consciousness we're talking about. So
yeah,
when I look at some of the people who I most regularly listen to and who have inspired me to get up and do this, they're looking at the selfish heart of the age too, and they're looking at different angles and trying to get to the bottom of it. When I think of people like Survive the Jive, The Golden One, Brittany Pettibone, Red Ice, the folks at This Week on the Alt-Right, Lauren Rose, Countercurrent, Stella Bell, Wife with a Purpose, Faith Goldie, You Yourself, Woes, and I know I'm forgetting people. You all, and I'm hoping to add to this, are addressing things in a very holistic way, and I think deeply care about people in life in general. So to reduce this to just it's just a rehash of some, you know, small-minded racist kind of thing, I wouldn't be here if it was that kind of thing. So, you know,
Is that because you would find it unpalatable, or because you'd find it shallow, or both, or what?
Probably both. I mean, as I said, I don't want to be misunderstood here. I understand how the crisis at hand and what's going on with European peoples, and it has to be a main focus. But as I said, I was thinking about this weeks ago, and funny enough, this was before, this has nothing to do with the Jordan Peterson Hydra, okay? I was thinking about it, and I had my own Hydra, nothing to do with his collectivism Hydra. And I was thinking that the heart of the beast is, as I said, over-specialized, siloed off, disjointed, fragmentary thinking. It's like if you cut off the neural pathways in a person's body, and the nerve firings, the information wasn't able to get across the whole body. I think that's how people are living now, where people are overly specialized in how they see the world.
Yeah. Yeah, I would say overly literal as well. I mean, there's a sort of, I don't like using the word autism in it casually, because I know it is a real condition and people live with it and all that, but there's a sort of learned autism. Yeah, there's a sort of learned autism now, I think. People demand proof, evidence. It's very black and white thinking, frankly. I mean, that's a cliche, but I mean, it's not an original comment to make, but I see it all the time now, especially in something, again, I'm sorry to go on about the skeptic community so much, but I see it in them as well. It's like, mm-hmm. 100 years ago, they would have had a more organic understanding of things, life, people, whereas now they see it in, if you make a statement, they take it very literally, and they demand evidence, and so on. And it just feels simplistic and cold and dishonest. But it's almost as you said, it's almost as if their neurons aren't firing correctly. Their brain is not functioning at optimal level.
Well, this is something that fascinates me, and people who take on a more traditional bent, like Survive the Jive, or there's a woman named Carolyn Emmerich, Völkisch folklorist. I've been reading some of her material. Subscribe to her on Patreon. Our ancestors, and this is so key, they saw ethnicity, language, land, myth, everything holistically together. And that's still in us. The only thing that's changed is technology, that we could take a plane and live in another part of the world. But they saw things they didn't see things. They lived in a holistic way. All of these things were congealed. It's like once you bake a cake, you can't extract the eggs from the cake.
Exactly. Yeah, that's a really good way of saying it.
My whole thing is holistic living. And as I said, that's because the modern consciousness, the root of it, the heart of the beast again, is this over-specialized, siloed off thinking. That's not saying that I don't want people to be specialists, again, just to maybe address the literalists out there. Obviously, if I go in for brain surgery, I want a guy who's only studied the brain for years. So, you know, let's not get funny about that. That's not what I'm saying. But the heads that allow this, that grow out of this partitioned way of viewing and living life, is less critical thinking. Like I've said, unnecessary dichotomies, food as a product. I'm big on that. Relationships as consumption, nihilism and relativism. We hear about all the time. Consumption as the only measure of your worth, imbalances in the sexes, mockery of life creating and life sustaining values. And of course, this big one, cutting people off from their history and traditions, their sense of time, their peoplehood, their sense of a story. I love how you talk about, you have to understand identity. I just did the first part of a video on this. It's the most recent thing. If people go to my channel right now, and I'm going to publish a part two after this. Understanding identity as action, it's not a passive thing. You're just sitting, like your European identity or your Scottish identity is just floating over you. It lives through you. It is an active thing. You engage with it. It lives through your actions. You know, these are things that I'm passionate about articulating and welling up in people, inspiring in people.
Yeah, it's very true. Again, this is another, I mean, the idea that your identity would just be something that you could be passive about is another form of consumerism. It's like, well, you've got this thing, so just sit comfy now. That is not how it works. Obviously, as you say, you go.
Oh no, I wasn't saying anything. But
I thought you were gearing up to intervene there. That's fine.
Oh, maybe it was just a sound. But well, I do have something I thought of to go on this, and it's that this. Not that what I'm about to say detracts one iota from just the real visceral ancestral connection. But there's another aspect of this, of why I'm doing this. It's not just, oh, I'm European, that's my team. I want to help my team. I want to help my team win. Anyone that comes at you like that. Now, again, I know not everyone's this philosophical, but some people, I think, do need to work these things out in their heads before they can even allow themselves to begin to feel into that ancestral emotional connection. So here's a whole other thing that is very important to me as well. This whole globalism thing is metaphysically incorrect. And I have a whole series of 9 foundational articles on my website that really go into this. But here's like an overview of it. So even if everybody mixed tomorrow, right, they would still develop differently in different places. So the mixed people in Australia would be different than the mixed people in Morocco or in Brazil, let's say. Diversity, true diversity, not the kind of imposed diversity that we have a problem with, but actual diversity in the original healthy sense of that term is a principle. And when you deny or you squash down a principle, it will pop back up again. It will reassert itself, usually in a more negative form, something we have to understand. But let's say, and this is going to sound conspiratorial, I'm not even saying one way or another how conscious or conspiratorial this is, so just please focus on more the logic of this. But the only way to sustain that global gray or that global beige would be for everyone on Earth to have no connection to the place where they currently are living. Because once you have any connection to the land that you're on, you will start to develop certain ways of being on that land. And as I said, there will differences will blossom. So again, the mixed people in Australia will be different than the mixed people in Morocco. To sustain this, people's attention would have to be entirely on simulations, on computing, on mass global products. So this is why the people who do have some kind of conspiratorial globalist theory or these dystopian visions, you could kind of see where they're going, because that's the only way that this would actually happen, because any connection to land and tradition usurps those attempts. So now we're actually in the kind of sci-fi dystopian visions that we have seen in science fiction for the last half century or more, however long, where people are just drones. So the reason that I am speaking out against this too is, again, not only that I'm on Team Europe, even though I am, but that just for everyone, the whole thing is anti-life and anti-human. You can't get around the fact that there are differences, and instead of trying to squash that, the only way out is through. You have to live through that. You have to understand there's going to be differences, and we have to understand how to deal with that rather than artificially suppress it and squash it.
Yeah, because of course, assuming that the population in Australia mixed now and just became 100% a soup of the various ingredients that are there, and the same thing happened in France, the resulting mixes would differ, and then again you would have inequality. You would have one population that was so on, and of course also that would be influenced by the geography. And so then the only solution would be to then mix those two populations in order to.
Right.
In order to get rid of the new diversity, the new inequality, rather.
Or like I said, the only way to stop them from developing differently would basically to have them full-time, their attention be on in some Borg-like, matrix-like state where everything is simulated. I'm not saying you're literally laying there with virtual reality goggles on the whole time, but so much of your life would have to be tuned into simulation and artificial things and computers, because as I said, the minute that people start connecting to the earth where they are, and this is where the pagans have a point and have something to teach us about our ancestry, the minute you start doing that, then that is going to start a domino effect of connecting to the land and establishing differences.
Well, I mean, I would say that, to be honest, I would say that modern culture is pretty much at that point.
It's already doing that, right. And it's...
You know, I watched a Taylor Swift video for the first time, about a week ago, and I just was overwhelmed by the... you know, pop culture ever since I was a teenager. I sort of grew out of it then and just forgot about it. But I sometimes you catch a glimpse of it as an adult, and it's every time a few more years have passed, and it's got even worse, and it's very scary. I mean, that Taylor Swift video, it was just non-stop sensation, stimulation, like sensory stimulation, with absolutely no meaning at all. It was just
right
drivel, you know. And it is amazing what is being served up now. The sheer force of it, of what's being served up to the public to keep them essentially distracted, just to keep them stimulated with meaningless stuff.
I like that, stimulation without meaning. That's a good, very succinct definition of a lot of this modern consciousness, because the tagline of my site is actually, this is a reaffirmation of meaning. That's, you know, the way that I was able to sum it all up in one sentence of the drive of what I'm doing. So I appreciate it.
Yeah, I think a lot of modern culture is essentially a sort of masturbation on meaninglessness.
Yes. And that is the discomfort that I had and you had, and has, I guess, led people like us to do this, which is something that reminds me, I think that that's a good juncture to say to people listening, this whole thing about people in these movements, especially young men, you know, being the basement dwellers and all that whole thing. So there's two sides to this. So I do want to start by saying, I'm not into victimhood. I'm not into placing external blame. You got to man up. You got to pick yourself up. You got to figure something out. You got to find some meaning. But that's the very thing. For those out there who listen to this at any point, I'm so big on this, is, again, don't go too far into the excuses. But if people have made you feel bad or odd for being out of place, the world is sick, so it's not necessarily healthy to be well-adjusted to a sick world. So your retreat from the world, I'm not saying to stay there, but it's been perhaps a first step from buffering yourself from these poisons. So don't let other people tell you that you're odd or you're a loser, you're never going to be anything. We're trying to create a space where people with a different kind of orientation, a different kind of, like we say, morality and aesthetics, or maybe they don't, maybe there are some people who aren't conscious of this, but they will be well suited for it once there's a space for it, you know, a magnet, once more of this is well articulated and well established. I want to make sure that people out there know, especially young men, that, again, no excuses, don't wallow in it, but the world is sick. It legitimately is sick, and your retreat from it is perhaps a natural response, you know, a natural immune response.
Well, there's a reason why so many thousands of people have done it at the same time. You know, it became possible. Yeah, it does feel like an immune reaction. It feels like the situation has become so bad, because fundamentally, I mean, we're all talking about the same malaise, especially the right wingers. I mean, I would say even some of the left wingers are talking about the same malaise, this sort of meaninglessness, chaos of modern life. But especially the right wingers, because they understand that there is a lack of hierarchy. And there's a lack of rootedness and so on. So this, and obviously it's not just a coincidence. There is something today that perpetuate that. And they might have their own internal order, but they don't work to produce an order that works for people in general. In fact, it's very much the opposite. I think that they serve to deracinate people and confuse them.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's forces that seem to just want to destroy all of this just for the sake of it. You know, obviously that's been spoken about at length. Are you there or just on mute?
Yeah. I always mute when I'm not speaking.
Gotcha, yeah. I even think about, you know, people who are quote-unquote successful by worldly standards. You know, it's funny to me that the male warlike instinct or battle instinct, it's funny, really funny to me when I see that funneled into business. And I'm not trying to harp on that because we need people running businesses, and I appreciate our entrepreneurial spirit, absolutely. But it is funny to me when you have these like city-dwelling people who all of their competitive striving that would have been more towards, you know, being in a military order or doing some kind of culture building. I mean, I know there's always been a merchant class as well, but I think of executives, like you could have this great high-powered job. You could be making multiple six figures, even millions of dollars a year in high up in a corporation. And let's say you work for Coke, and it's like you work for Coke only because it offered you a better retirement package than Pepsi did. And so the majority of your waking life, you're going to war with, you work for Coke and you're going to war with Pepsi, and everything you guys are doing, you're trying to outmaneuver Pepsi. And, you know, you're like grown men and some women putting all of this time and energy. And some of them are very, and I guess in at least a specialized way, you could say intelligent, and have all this energy, and they're putting it towards basically going to war for a soft drink company, for something that shouldn't even be classified as food. And even though they're materially successful, I have to wonder about those, you know, people like that, their sense of meaning. You know, I see it. I came from a city, and I see even these, you know, wealthy women that don't work, the wives who, it's amazing. They have all this time on their hands, and they still have nannies. They still choose to have someone else raise their kids and be with their kids for the bulk of the day because they take 4-hour lunches and go to yoga. I don't envy these people at all. I pity them. You used a word before, and it's one that I use in a lot of contexts as well, and that's cold. And a lot of this is cold to me, and I'm looking for the warmth of life, the warmth of burning. And as I said, I'm finding it. I found the meaning in my own life individually. I have found more of it when I connected more deeply to my roots, and I'm doing what I can to connect with other people so that we can fan these flames. Because as imperfect as it is, as messy as it is, even conversations, I know people say, what is all this talking on YouTube going to do? The thing you got to understand is there are people who have, like lone wolves, who have written manifestos before, and they had total clarity about what they wanted a whole society to look like. Just because they had clarity in their manifesto, does that mean that everyone went and then followed them? No, obviously not. Like, this stuff has to happen organically with all these little cells, with all people like us talking, and slowly it's going to be messy and people are going to disagree. And that's why I say, you know, people can't get so worked up about these little rivalries. We're going to disagree. There's going to be debates, but there's something pulling us. There's something we know is wrong with the modern world, and we're trying to come to alternatives. And I say, take joy in it, you know, get in the game, get in the conversation.
Yeah. This is something that always amazes me about, well, in the British context, well, not just British, let's just say in nationalist circles, when people say, all we're doing is talking. Yes, I know. But for a start, that doesn't stop anyone else from doing things. So, I mean, they always assume that, well, everyone who's involved should be doing everything. Right. So, you know, I should be standing for government and, you know, whatever. So there's that. And also, all the talking is useful, because by talking, we are building up a culture. And I hate this in very literal thinking about the situation, that, well, if you're talking, you're not doing something. So you're just wasting people's time. And I think that is just so short-sighted. You know, this is a very, it's going to go on forever. It's going to go on for a long time. I don't know if I'll be involved in it for forever. I don't think so. But this sort of fabric of discussion, discourse, is obviously going to be very extensive, and that's as it should be, because this is about the promulgation and creation of ideas. So, yeah, don't be surprised that there's a lot of verbiage involved.
Yes.
Else, I mean, we could just decide to take action right now. But I don't think that would be, obviously we should take some actions. But I think it would be dishonest to just say, right, we know what to do. And that's the end of the matter. You might know what to do in terms of securing a city from a takeover, or how to close a border. But what then? I think a lot of people don't quite understand the scope of what we're dealing with here. You know, I mean, if we got rid of all the, especially if we got rid of all the non-whites, if we successfully sent them back to their ancestral countries, that still wouldn't be the end of the matter.
Right, because we're looking for creating in our own people, and of course, I advocate for this in all peoples, but looking in our own people for nobility and inspiring people to nobility. And that's why that list of figures that I mentioned earlier, I support them. I usually don't say things like this, but I guess in this context, it is important. I encourage people to donate financially, and I do myself. Even though I'm a content creator and I was just starting, I wanted to put that out there, and I wasn't expecting people to get back to me and figure out who I was just because of that. Most of them didn't. And I'm happy about that. I wasn't trying to buy anyone's attention. I was just trying to thank people because of the education and the inspiration that I have been receiving. So I understand that people have a sense of urgency because there is this huge culture creation thing going on and kind of righting the ship. That's another way you could think of the word right in all this, right? The ship's going the wrong direction. We're trying to right the ship, get back in line, get back on course. But there is, of course, the very real, tangible, visceral attacks, literal and existential, on our family, on our extended family, on the peoples of Europe. So I could understand someone listening to us, if we go on a little bit too much, wanting to say, hey guys, you know, guess what? There's still terrorist attacks. There's still all this unfettered immigration. So, okay, I get you. So I have some things that I think about, and I'm not saying this is all new, but I just have some things to throw out there. First of all, I understand that elected office and things like that may be way, way, way far off. But from my understanding, there are some more attorneys that are warming up to some of what we're doing. And in the United States, I understand that some people are trying to invoke civil rights laws, but to protect people of European heritage when the pendulum has swung too far the other way. Or in Britain, I know that there are documented cases where there's the same crime, but the sentencing is different if the person is of a minority status. And I've learned about this through YouTuber Social Free State. It's spelled Social, the number 3 state. She's actually a rape survivor.
We
started right around the same time, and we've been in touch behind the scenes, and we may be speaking soon, but she's been talking about this, where if someone, if there's a perpetrator that attacks a non-white victim, the perpetrator gets a longer sentence than the same crime where the perpetrator attacked a white victim, because the minority is seen in Britain as being more sensitive, or, you know, a more sensitive population. So we need to look at these civil rights laws, certain human rights laws that are running counter, and try to use the legal system as best we can. I understand that some people are starting to drum up more around that. And then there's also, I have some ideas about artistic activism. I kind of like the shock tactics of the identitarians in Europe. And I know Identity Europe in the States is starting to do more of this kind of just show up, you know, do some kind of flash mob stuff and leave, right? Okay. So that kind of shocks people, jolts people into a certain awareness. And I have ideas, you know, I'm way ahead of myself. So it's not about me. I just want these ideas out there. I want them waking people up. So steal these ideas. I'm going to do a series of videos called Steal These Ideas. But since we're talking now and you have a good platform, I'll just share some things now. I have ideas.
Absolutely.
Like,
absolutely. Go ahead. Go ahead.
Like, I would love to see something like this. Okay. Picture this. So it has to be well shot. That's the thing. It has to have some professionalism to it to have the impact. But let's say you do a mock commercial where the first 10 seconds is dramatic music and figures and shadows and a voiceover. And it looks like it's going to be yet another one of these commercials for a charity for kids in Africa or South America or Asia, which is all well and good, fine. But the big reveal is when you start to see the faces, it's for the kids, the white kids in South Africa, which I think is a huge problem. We just got to get those people out of there. Or it's a video about the girls who have been victims of the sex grooming gangs in Europe. Another idea, again, you know, it's got to be professionally shot. You have someone playing a piano, like a nice piece of classical music, and there's close-up on their, you know, their fingers manipulating the piano keys, and there's a voiceover that says something to the effect of, "This is true diversity," or "This is nationalism," whatever the best verbiage is. And then after a few seconds of playing that beautiful music, the pianist slams both hands on the piano and makes that ugly clanking sound of all the piano keys being hit at once. And the voiceover goes, "This is globalism. Any questions?" Like that kind of thing. You know, we need to start doing that kind of artistic activism.
I think that's absolutely true, because it's like the difference between showing and telling. You know, you can come up with a way of giving people the idea without tediously explaining it. You know, it's incredibly powerful. We really should. I mean, again, the left knew this decades and decades ago, and they've been doing it every single fucking day. So we need to get into that as well. We need to get much cleverer.
Yes. I don't know if this made it to Britain, but the piano thing I just said kind of references a drug video, a drug PSA, public service announcement, that was played in the States a while ago, where they would take an egg and say, "This is your brain." They'd crack the egg. It would start frying on a frying pan. And the frying egg, they go, "This is your brain on drugs. Any questions?" So maybe it didn't make it to Britain, but especially people in the States who would remember that commercial, it would have that double whammy of kind of bringing up something from their youth. I also have this idea of lectures from the future, where you get someone lecturing like a professor, and it's shot like it's just a, you know, fly on the wall kind of thing in a lecture hall, in a university, and it's set 75 years in the future. And the professor is just calmly, methodically explaining how thoughts and practices in the late 20th and early 21st century just wrecked things, and what happened to kind of rectify it, to kind of give people now a sense of where this could go. To kind of, it would be interesting information, but it would also give people an emotional goal, an emotional vision of, we can get out of this, the future can be different.
Well, indeed, it's similar to what I was trying to do with my Erkenbrand speech. Of course, the danger is that any predictions you make, they might not be correct. But I guess that doesn't really matter in the here and now, does it? Because no one knows that if they're incorrect. I think that the point is the emotional punch that would have for people in the present.
Sure. The thing about that idea of the lectures from the future would be, at least half of it wouldn't be future projection. You know, at least half of it would be this whole methodical takedown of the post-World War II consensus, post-modernism. And it would kind of give people on the fence, or people in the middle, this sense of, you know, maybe the left, as they try to make it seem like they're not on the right side of history. So even if that lectures from the future didn't get into future forecasting, I myself, just personally, I'm not really into future forecasting. So many things can happen. I'm just trying to do what I can here and now. But a lot of that, you know, I just want to make clear that future lectures from the future idea would be about a professor, again, 50, 75 years in the future, whatever it is, kind of just showing, you know, this is what it led to. It led to these wars. It led to these conflicts. It led to you know, this welfare and this immigration. I mean, it's funny that we would have to put it in the future and that people can't understand now that it's so problematic. But
well, indeed. But I think that, well, of course, but because the thing about putting it in the future would be that you could show how it, the disaster that it led to and the resolution that it made necessary.
Yeah.
And also the better world that came about as a result of that. You know, I often think how, like, I'll see something in the present day, some astonishing degenerate piece of filth or, you know, disarray, and I'll think, how on earth will this look to our descendants? Of course, assuming that we do have descendants, and I am assuming, for the sake of my staying afloat, I'm assuming that the white race is going to survive, to be honest. But anyway, how when they look back at this era, perfect example is that trans demon reading. It was in some school,
yes, I know the picture school. You're talking about.
Yeah, and he's, I mean, it's unbelievable. He looks terrifying. If I were a child, I would be terrified. It's not enough that he's a transvestite or whatever, transsexual. He just happens to be a demonic one. I mean, it's like, just to be a transvestite wouldn't be enough. You know, it has to be even more confusing for the children and actively terrifying for the children.
I know. Maybe the excuse was it was Halloween. I mean, I don't know the story of that picture, but I know the picture you're talking about. And I think the same exact thing. And I've thought it for a long time. Again, long before there was something called the alt-right, long before I was doing this, I had the exact same thought you do, Woz. That I would look at things and be like, what is this going to look like in the future? You know, not to get into this way, but even abortion. Like, oh yeah, they kill babies in the womb. Awesome. You know, great.
Yeah.
Like,
or, you know, or something as insane as Angela Merkel saying that she doesn't know the difference between from looking at someone, whether they're a German or not, whether they're a German passport or not. Because, you know, that's what she means. She means that she doesn't know if they have a German passport. You know, that kind of affected bafflement, utter dishonesty. And, you know, you've got an entire culture of politicians schooled in that dishonesty and mandated to perform it. You know, that is just an amazing statement on the age that we live in.
Absolutely.
And again, I always think, because I always hope that, you know, 100 years from now, we will not be in this situation anymore. We'll be in something vastly different. And so they'll be able to look back on this and think, oh my God, this was just a brothel of confusions and mistakes, all being acted out a million times a day, you know?
A brothel of confusion and mistakes. That sounds like a great name for a book. I like that. Oh my God.
Well, is there anything else? Is there anything else that you'd like to talk about before we wrap up? I think we've been going for 50 minutes now.
Well, it's flown by, as I figured it would. It's been such a pleasure. I would, actually, if you have a few more minutes, I just want to at least get this one thing in. Talking about the spirit of Europe and our ancestors living through us. So let's talk about the time of year we're in right now. I love all times of year and this changing of the seasons, but like most people, there's something special about Christmas and Yule. And there's this idea of a Europeanness moving through us. And by the way, just quick aside, this has nothing to do with Yule, but on that note, I did a recent series of 5 videos too that summarize Weakness of Western Civilization by Ricardo Duchesne. So anyone that wants to get a little deeper into what makes us us and what's a little different about, say, the Iliad versus an epic poem from the Middle East and what it says about the differences and how you can kind of draw a line from the ancient Greeks through the berserkers, through the medieval knights, to the hands off my guns and land freedom-loving Americans today. It really shows you the spirit that has lived in the peoples of Europe. And it's a great book. I recommend you read it, but I did a series of articles on that. But taking notes from that. But anyway, so the Yule European spirit, you look at, you know, even fundamentalist Christians or even non-religious people, most of us, and you could say, a cynic could say that it's just the momentum of a custom, but I don't quite buy that. Why do we put up elves and reindeer and images of Santa for the Christmas and tell our kids that Santa for the Christmas is bringing gifts and we decorate the tree and we feast? Again, a cynic would say something like, this, you can't prove this. There's no way to rationalize it. You can't touch this European folk spirit, right? And I would say to that cynic,
that's a good example of the literal thinking we were talking about earlier.
Right, right, exactly. And I would say to that question, to that critique, I can't touch the ineffable love that you have between you and your wife, let's say, or you and your children. So what is that? You know, it's this ethereal thing, love. And he would probably say that, okay, you can see in the actions I take and what I do for my wife and my children, his expressions. And I would say, ah, thank you for proving my point. That's exactly what I'm saying. And so many other people are talking about this. And that's why it's important we have those who are reteaching us about our traditions. We're back to where we started with elves and reindeer and Santa, Father Christmas. You know, why are we compelled to put these things up? And why is there a spirit that seems to pervade this time of year? One of my favorite videos is when 2 years ago, a millennial, and honestly, I wasn't even listening to you regularly then, but it came up and I listened to this and I listened to it recently again, of you, Survive the Jive, Gra, and Yarnifer from the Wolves. And you guys talked about Yule and the pagan connections with Yule. And it was an amazing thing. I'd recommend everyone to check it out. But I think Gra towards the end went on this little soliloquy and he talked about how even through commercialism, even through consumerism, in those imperfect ways, the spirit of Yule and Christmas and what's even gone before that, as someone like Survive the Jive can explain, is living. It will take whatever form it needs to. It's like water. You know, it's going to just follow, it's going to express where it needs to, and even if it's through shallow consumerism. You know, in school, I went to parochial school, and I was taught, of course, Christ is the real reason for the season. And we haven't gotten to speak about religion, by the way. I'm not taking a side with pagan and Christian. That's a really interesting thing to me, and my thing is kind of mining through both of those what it means to be European. But I'm not speaking as a pagan or a Christian. I just want to say that. But I was taught Christ is the real reason for the season, and that Santa was, of course, just some extra detail, some meaningless thing, fun for kids. But now as an adult, I realize that Santa and Father Christmas are a hell of a lot more real than I thought. You know, this, again, this season, my heart swells. It's hard to define. It's beyond rationality. And there's a lot of other people who have poured a lot of time and energy into this season, too, and crafting stories and writing songs. And again, you could say, yeah, it's just to make money, just to have a Christmas song. You know, you make a lot of money if you write a Christmas song. But there are people writing Christmas songs, writing Christmas stories a long time ago, before the last several decades when it was more commercialized. It lives on, you know, it, as I said, in any form. But what we're doing right now, even you and I speaking, the fact that you have millennial, like, why don't you do this in August or April? Why are we having
exactly? I was just going to say, when you were talking about people putting in a lot of effort towards this time of year, I couldn't help thinking back to all the work I put into arranging this. I was thinking, yeah, because it is important. I mean, it is very important to me that the channel becomes, at this time of year, becomes a sort of safe haven and a warm place for people. Because I think throughout the year, we do so much work and struggle, and you know, we go out into the nothingness and take chances. And I think it's nice for at this time of year for us to come to one place and be safe and comfortable.
That's exactly
what I would like this channel to be at this time of year.
I sense that, and I'm sure a lot of other people do, and that's why this has become a thing. Like you just said, why do you put the effort into it? Why do people take time out of their busy schedules to make sure I know you have a variety of guests, and obviously you're going to be speaking to some people that don't agree with you, which is a good thing. But in general, the thrust of what you're doing, and what I would imagine most of the people who want to speak to you, what binds all of us is this deep feeling for European roots and correcting the sicknesses, and again, helping our people fall in love with their roots again and thrive again. Why do we do that at this time of the year? The Yule spirit is living through you doing this, you and I having this conversation right now. So this is proof positive that these rhythms and these symbols, this life is in us. It's right under our noses. We just have to acknowledge it and fan the flames a little bit more. In fact, I have something I've come to informally call, just as a joke with myself, the Yule rule. I would never want to live somewhere where it's hot in December. It doesn't make sense.
Oh, God,
to me.
No.
You know, I want it to be cold. I want there to be snow. You know, it's in our bones. This is part of who we are. And I know, no offense to people who live in Australia, you know, but
we extend our sympathies.
Love you, sending my love down under, but that's just my thing with it. And on that note, with the whole European spirit, I do want to say this too. Obviously the crises wake people up, but again, I see little hints, and I'm sure this will just come out as I produce more content and have more conversations, but that spirit was in me, and I know that I would be doing something to further that. It would be living through me in some way, even if we weren't living through these crises, even if there wasn't this mass migration, even if there wasn't this intellectual war against white European identity. Obviously, the times would be very different, circumstances would be different, so it would call for my life, you know, all of our lives would be a little different. We'd be called in different ways. But I want people to know that this isn't just, it's not just a reaction, like, oh, there's bad things going on, there's a fight, so let me get involved in the fight. This, every generation has its, nothing's taken for granted. Every generation has its way that it must perpetuate and continue and keep alive. That's what I mean when I say identity is an activity. Keep alive what this heritage is that lives in us, that's gone back thousands of generations. So I'd be doing something to perpetuate this spirit. It would be living through me in some way. Again, I could see it in things I wrote, in things I was attracted to, even when I was 9, 10 years old. So leave it at that.
Okay. I've got nothing to add to that. I think you're absolutely right. And indeed, identity is something that I think it's better actually that it is something active and ongoing, because otherwise it's something static. And frankly, that's a bit, it's harder for everyday people to get into something that is static and which they're just expected to learn about and then worship and sort of preserve obsessively. Identity is something organic and that it constantly evolves and revitalizes and is revitalized and revitalizes itself.
Yes, I don't think anyone.
It's really a matter of being aware of that process. It's really a matter of being aware of that process and taking part in it.
I think a lot of the antidote to modern consciousness is just being aware. Period. Just being aware. But to your point, yes, I don't think anyone of our ancestors lived that way where it was just static. And when I've had conversations about art and creativity, because I'm interested in that, I have some poems I wrote on my website, and I have a background in music, and I hope that songwriting and music will eventually figure into my platform. But there's a place for people reviving old traditional styles, and there's a place for new as well. The main thing is the spirit behind it. So there's a place for earthy acoustic guitars, and there's a place for synthesizers. There's a place for paint, and there's a place for computer graphic design. You know, I don't like these false clefts and these false dichotomies between the two. I think there's going to be really interesting ways people can merge both.
Absolutely, absolutely. That gets us onto another subject altogether, but I think that the point is that indeed these are advancements of a single continuum.
Yes.
In each case.
Look to the spirit first.
And not just And when I say advancements, I don't necessarily mean that the latter one is better, the latter incarnation is superior to the earlier incarnation. I just mean that they are of one continuum.
Yes.
So, excellent. Well, this has been fascinating. So I'm sorry if I was a bit slow at the beginning. I was still waking up, so I haven't had much sleep due to various stresses today. So, all right. Well, thank you very much, Jared, from The Great Order. And you have a YouTube channel and a website. I'll link the website as well below, but just now the YouTube channel is there.
Yes. So, the website has some other things going on and a list, because I figure we don't know what's going on with social media, and it's always better to get direct connection to a content creator. But I really enjoyed this, and thank you for everything that you do. Merry Christmas and glad Yule, good Yule to you. And hopefully we'll speak soon.
Yes, indeed. And Merry Christmas and glad Yule to you as well. All right. Well, the next one will be in about half an hour, and it's with a guy who studies and teaches ancient forms of English, I believe.
Alde Englischer, right? Alde Englischer.
I wasn't going to try to pronounce it.
I don't know if I'm doing that correctly or not, but that's really cool you have it on.
Yeah, we'll see. It should be quite interesting. Okay, then. Well, Jared from The Great Order, thank you. And thank you for listening. I'll see you again soon.